Bremner, reel number two.
But then what I always consider the most heroic thing happened, that you changed places with your instructor. You sat in the seat, and he sat behind you. He couldn't reach the rudder bar. All he could do was to hold the joystick, get his hand on the joystick around your shoulder. And you then proceeded to go off. When he thought or when he'd had enough of it, I suppose, you're then allowed to take the machine out by yourself and do circuits. First of all, hops, and then circuits.
What were hops?
Well, just in a straight line, you just took the machine off and then flew about 10 or 15 yards and put it down again.
Sounds like a pretty bouncy kind of activity.
It was at times. Then you did circuits. And then you had to take your pilot's ticket.
When you first went to Chingford, how were you and your fellow recruits received?
Well, the officer in charge of flying, the first lieutenant was a naval lieutenant called Sitwell, who was very pucker navy, and he was quite determined to turn us into pucker naval officers, which was a bit tough in a way, perhaps. But we soon got used to it, and I'm sure he did.
Why was it tough?
Well, being pitched into full naval discipline is a little difficult at first.
Do you remember any particular things that caused problems for the new recruits?
Well, not so much myself, because having been a rating for a year, I knew some of the things that you had to do in the Navy. You had to obey all orders at the double. You never walked, you always ran when you were told to do something. And you always had to come back and report that you had carried out the order. And then there was saluting in the correct way. I think some of the people found it a little difficult to remember it all the time.
Was the mess a very formal...
The mess was... Okay. Sitwell always ran the mess on a very formal lines, with a certain with a certain amount of fun behind it. One of the things we used to take turns to be president of the mess at dinner, and then the thing to do was to knock people down for drinks. For any wrong behaviour at dinner. Of course, the dreadful thing to do was to mention a lady's name before the loyal toast. One of the silly things, silly in inverted commas, was that you weren't allowed to eat soup with two hands.
So you couldn't tip your plate?
You couldn't tip your plate. And if you got somebody doing something wrong and you knocked him down for drinks... well, then, of course, it was pretty expensive. You had to spend drinks all around. So what you had to do then was to watch carefully, and every slight misdemeanor of any sort, you'd knock him down for drinks, so that by the time you'd finished dinner, you had a sufficient number of people knocked down to share the bill for drinks. It really didn't amount to much.
Tell me a bit more about being mess president. What did that involve?
Well, just sitting at the head of the table and calling for the loyal toast and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we always drank the loyal toast sitting down.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, so naval messes even ashore were allowed to do that. It was a relic of the old days when in the wardroom you couldn't stand up.
During this period of initial training, were there any particular exercises which you were given to carry out?
My first cross-country flight was after 27 hours in the air, 27 hours instruction. And I had to fly to Northolt Aerodrome.
From Chingford.
The clouds were low, and so I went above the clouds, steered by a compass. And when I thought... that I was over Northolt, I came down through the clouds, saw the reservoir, but couldn't recognize the aerodrome. I started looking for it and got hopelessly lost. So I went above the clouds again and steered by sun due west, because I was quite sure I was clear of London. Then I steered south till I found the Thames, and then followed the Thames till I found Hampton Court, recognized Hampton Court. And then I set off a course again for Northolt, and went up through the mist into where I could see the sun, steered by sun, and came down again till I found the reservoir again. I then started looking again and recognized Greenford, well, the name of the factory. Then I saw a railway. I went down low till I came to a railway station, read the name on the station, Northolt, and then I spotted the aerodrome, which I landed all right.
So in effect, you'd been to the same place twice, yes, but hadn't recognised it the first time. Why did you fly by sun? Why didn't you?
The compass. The compass was behaving very queerly, and I just didn't trust it.
Mm. Did that kind of thing often happen?
In those days, one wasn't flying very often and needed a compass. It was mostly local flying.
So you could navigate by landmarks, which were fairly well known.
I flew, coming back from Northolt, I kept landmarks in sight all the time. I flew low and kept landmarks in sight all the time, no trouble.
Did you fly any other airplanes while you were at Chingford, apart from box kite?
Yes, quite a certain number. After the box kite, one went on to the Morris Farman Longhorn, which was a big, rather clumsy aeroplane, but very pleasant to fly. It was a pusher, so if you were sitting out in front of it in a nice comfortable nacelle, it was very comfortable.
What main differences did you notice between these two aircraft that you'd flown so far, the box kite and the Farman?
Oh, I think it was rather like the difference between a good motor car and a sort of homemade cycle car thing. It was properly laid out. You had an airspeed indicator, and you were protected from most of the elements. In a nacelle, you had a comfortable seat. And the rudder bar, you weren't looking down straight down onto the ground as you were in a box kite. And then after that, I flew.
Did you use the instrumentation, the additional instrumentation on the Farman, very much?
Yes, and yes, you had to get used to flying at the right speed. You recognized your speed one by whether the machine was allowable to stall or not, or a kind of stalling feeling, which all the controls went soggy, which was very dangerous in those days. It's all like the speedometer in a motor car. Do you use your speedometer? Well, you use it when you get onto a new motor car. You use your speedometer in order to know what speed you're traveling at. And if you're good at it, you ought to be able to drive your car 30 miles an hour or 40 miles an hour without looking at the speedometer. You should know the feel of it. Mm. And to that extent, yes, one did use the speedometer.
So the instrumentation really was helpful, because it was helpful in introducing you to a new airplane, which you didn't have the feel of immediately.
Yes, yes.
Mm. What other airplanes?
The marvellous old aeroplane, the Avro 504K.
You like that one?
Oh, it was a wonderful machine. You could do anything in it. I mean, with a box kite, if you stalled a box kite, I think you'd hate it. With a Avro 504K, it just didn't matter. If you were high enough up, as long as you got room underneath you, You could do anything with it. If you stole it, it just you could let it die and then pull it out, or just do what you want. Then I flew the BE-2C.
How'd you get on with that?
That was a queer machine because it was stable. Except you had to keep your feet on the rudder bar, but otherwise you could let go of everything and she'd fly herself. But it had one dangerous trick. If you did a bad stall in it, then whatever you did, it would die 500 feet. And if you were only 400 feet of space underneath you, you were for it. Whereas the arrow, you could have probably pulled out and pancaked down. But otherwise, the B-2C was a very fine machine. Another machine which I flew was the JN-4 Curtiss. This was an American machine. The main difference was the engine was very much more silent, very pleasant. And instead of a joystick, it had the joystick only had a fore and aft movement, and the lateral movement was by means of a wheel, like a motor car steering wheel on top of the joystick. This machine had a very bad reputation at Chingford. It was always said that if you stalled it, you could never get out of it. So they got Sidney Pickles, who was a commercial test pilot, to come and fly our JN-4s, and he took one up and threw it about in the air and stalled it. Really bad stalls, and there was no trouble about getting it out of it. And he, I think we all liked them after that. I certainly liked it. I never had any trouble with it. Well, that's after my take.
What other airplanes did you experience at Chingford?
Well, one of the machines I was supposed to fly but never did was at Chingford was the Bristol Scout, which was Barnwell's baby, it was known as. I was going to be drafted to fly them on service, and I went with the CO to see one and found I couldn't get in. When I got my feet under the crossbar on the fuselage and tried to slide down the back of the seat, my knees wouldn't get under the crossbar. I just couldn't get in. So the CO reported that I was it was too big for a Bristol Scout, and recommended that I should be sent to Westcliff to fly seaplanes.
So that was the coincidental way by which you went on to seaplanes?
Well, I never went on seaplanes, no. Because the Admiralty took no notice of that and drafted me to Dover to fly the Bristol Scout there. So I went down to Dover and we examined, had a real look at the Bristol Scout and thought I must get in somehow. And I found that by taking the seat out of the chair, taking the cushion out of the seat, that dropped my bottom sufficiently far to enable my thighs to be at such an angle that my knees would just clear the bar. Mm.
So you're what, about 6 foot two, something like that?
Yes, I'm six foot two, 6 foot three.
Yes.
And it was uncomfortable because having got in, then I couldn't get the seat down, the cushion down behind me, so I had to sit on the bolt heads which bolted the seat to the machine.
Were you impeded in any way in actually flying?
No, not a bit. Yeah. Not a bit. Once I was in, and it was the best machine I ever flew. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Before we go on, do you remember anything about actually taking your ticket at Chingford? What were the stages involved?
Well, that was rather a formality. One had to take a machine up, and I think I took mine in a box kite. And fly figure of eights in the air for a bit, and then land. Somebody was sent out into the middle of the aerodrome waving a white handkerchief, and you had to land within so many yards of him. And when you switched off and he could see how you were coming down, he then had to run as hard as he could to be within the stated number of yards from you when you stopped.
That hardly sounds like landing at the mark.
Not quite. Not quite.
I believe you had the shortest of possible trips in a Blériot while you were at Chingford.
Yes, I flew one of the old Blériots which we had there. It was the same type that Blériot flew the Channel. And I went down to the bottom of the aerodrome, took her off, did a straight. And as soon as I got into the air, the inlet valve stuck and I had the engine conked and I had to come down. I went back and tried again and got well and truly in the air, flying straight towards the sheds, and the engine conked for a second time. So I had to put it down again and turn very rapidly to the left. That was all right because the wheels had a very heavy caster action, would take any amount of turning. And she spun round and my right wingtip almost took all the machines which were standing in the tarmac, but missed them a matter of feet. And that was my first and last trip in a Blériot.
I'm rather surprised that they had this airplane at a training station.
Yes, I can't think why. We had another queer machine there, which I never flew, called the Sparrow, which was supposed to be one of the stunt fighters, but I think it was a hopeless sort of thing.